Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Once upon a time, the New England Mafia brought to mind names like Raymond Patriarca and lucrative crimes like loan sharking, gambling, and racketeering. It also evoked a code of honor and silence that kept the mob alive for generations.
But now the New England mob is a shadow of what it once was. Patriarca died in 1984. Since then, one by one, members of the mob have been indicted on criminal charges and locked up.
The latest is Anthony DiNunzio, the alleged don of the New England Mafia, arrested last Wednesday on charges of racketeering and extorting strip clubs in Providence. So, with his arrest, what's left of the New England mob?
To help us with that question, we're joined by Arlene Violet. She's the former Attorney General of Rhode Island and co-author of the memoir The Mob and Me. She also wrote a musical about the mob called The Family. And Arlene Violet, welcome to Radio Boston. Great to have you.
Well, thank you very much.
So you confronted organized crime in a big way as a special assistant in the Attorney General's office back in the 70s, then later as Attorney General of Rhode Island. Tell me, first of all, about the mob that you faced back then.
Well, back in those days, the mob certainly had a lot more discipline than it has in its current mode, to say the least. You know, certainly Raymond Patriarca ruled with an eye in hand. There was discipline in the ranks. One would never think of turning in anybody else that was a fellow mobster. And, of course, they did what Raymond Patriarca demanded that they did without question. But that began to erode. And more various mobsters who thought they should have gotten a promotion but didn't, sometimes, in fact, would become the sources of the information that were given to us in law enforcement, because they thought they should have gotten the promotion instead of the man who did. And then some young mobsters thought they were taking all the risks. They shouldn't have to pay, quote-unquote, the tribute to the bosses, and they wouldn't turn over the monies.
So what's left of the mob in New England today? We mentioned that Anthony DiNunzio, the alleged don of the New England mob, arrested last Wednesday on charges of, what, extorting strip clubs in Providence? Doesn't sound like the kind of work that this kind of business used to get you involved, used to get the mobsters involved in.
Well, why they did do shakedowns back in those days, they had a much wider repertoire. But certainly the racketeering statute certainly dismantled the mob. And to answer directly your question, the mob really is a shadow of its former self. Even Mr. DiNunzio, I thought it was so strange that he would take the position of constantly talking about what he would be doing to people. And he also thought there was an informant higher up in his organization that was, in fact, colluding with the FBI, yet he continued the extortion scheme, etc. In the old days, the mobsters were far too smart, in fact, to do something like that.
There was an interesting quote from you in the Boston Globe this morning on this story in which you referred to DiNunzio as sleazy. You said their crimes, the mafia crimes, aren't as sexy anymore. Explain what you meant by that.
Well, it was really just run-of-the-mill that they're doing right now with extortion of sex clubs and strip clubs. Please, you know, in the old days, the mobsters would really give the Bernie Madoffs a run for their money because of the schemes that they had hatched that were on Wall Street and really were brilliant schemes, even the way they fixed horse races, for example. The armored truck heist that they did, the union pension funds were the mob's piggy banks, but they did it in such a way that they were very clever schemes. Now it's sort of like a grab a purse kind of thing by sleaze activities like shaking down these types of strip clubs.
So, you know, you mentioned that a lot of these mafia folks are sort of turning against each other. But what kind of tools has law enforcement been able to bring to bear to really break the back of the Northeastern mob?
Well, number one has been the racketeering statute that was enacted in 1970, because you were able then to seize the so-called, quote-unquote, instrumentalities of the crime. And what that basically meant is that you could confiscate the money. If something was done with an automobile, you could take the automobile, you could take the house, you could take everything. And also that statute afforded a new tool where you could get at the top guy, because while there were some theories and common law theories to try to reach the top boss, the fact of the matter is people were only convicting mobsters who actually perpetrated the crime directly, for example, by pulling the trigger. But with the racketeering statute, it provided a format whereby you could actually reach the person who ordered the murder, even though the boss didn't pull the trigger himself. So in my view, that was the single most important tool that dismantled the mob.
Let me ask you about this. You know, I'm trying to think about your history in law enforcement and thinking back to the 70s when a mob boss like Raymond Patriarca ran a criminal empire that ran from Rhode Island, I guess point south of Rhode Island, all the way up to Maine. Did you think back then that you'd ever see the day when it really would be a shadow of itself, as you describe the mafia today?
Not really, because they certainly had about 5,000 members and probably 22 families that, in fact, then got reduced down to 5 so-called crime families. Raymond Patriarca was so strong, there wasn't a ship that was unloaded on the docks in New York City that didn't pay money to him. So his reach was even beyond New England. But as time went on, you could actually see, though, a break in the discipline, a break in omerta. Yeah. Obviously.
Omerta, that's the sort of code of silence, right, where they don't turn each other in.
That's right. And certainly the old timers maintain that. But new people coming in who were disgruntled because they didn't get the recognition they thought they deserved, they would breach omerta. And I think eventually that brought down the mob along with the tool like the Racketeering Act.
Well, do you see anything taking the place of that old style organized crime these days? Is there a modern day mafia at the forefront?
Well, in a way, I see gangs in neighborhoods as really a facsimile of what the mob is. Generally, an ethnic group will stick together because they tend to be victimized by the broader population. They try to do and help one another out, and then other people emerge within that group to become the strong arms, which is actually the history of what happened at the start of organized crime. So in many ways, I think gangs get that way, at least initially. However, they don't seem to do the same kind of good things that organized crime, including the mafia, did for people in the neighborhood. In Rhode Island, for example, where Raymond Patriarca had his office up on Federal Hill, the joke was that he had 1,000 eyes that watched out for law enforcement, and those 1,000 eyes belonged to the old ladies in the neighborhood, because he had done some good things for them, helped them with monies for their rent, etc. So if law enforcement were in the neighborhood, it would be the gray hairs that would let Raymond Patriarca know that there's a strange black car around here. It must belong to law enforcement. They were more loyal to him than so-called law enforcement. So from my perspective, that is also broken down, because I don't see the type of, at least an aspect of generosity, including with Mr. D'Annunzio in Boston. That has totally broken down.
Well, Arlene Violet, thanks so much for talking to us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you. All the best.
That's Arlene Violet. She's an attorney and the former Attorney General of Rhode Island. She's also co-author of the memoir, The Mob and Me.
Well, stay with us, because up next, everybody loves to talk about themselves. Some people, maybe a little too much, but new research from Harvard suggests there may be a biological reason behind the urge to share TMI. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.